compellingly inclusive and fully woke. Diverse and unpredictable conversations. Equality for your day. Your non-triggering, non-toxic ally. This is The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Now wait a doggone minute. What was that again? You had me all set up for that.
I did.
I've never heard that before.
That's fun.
So walk me through this. So I'm the non-triggering, what am I now?
Do you want me to just play it again?
Go ahead and play it again. Go ahead.
All right. Listen close this time.
I'm going to listen. All right.
Compellingly inclusive and fully woke. Diverse and unpredictable conversations. Equality for your day. Your non-triggering, non-toxic ally. This is The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
What do you think?
I like that.
You like that?
I think it's truth in advertising as well.
Uh-huh. Well, some people get triggered.
Well, that's true. I guess I am triggering for some people. But the one thing I would take issue with would be the woke issue. Other than that, though, I'm awake. That's for sure.
That's all I mean.
Yeah. Oh, if that's what it means, then yeah.
Yeah, we're good.
Four cups of coffee in me by the time the show starts. No, definitely. I like that. That's clever. Thank you, Cyrus. Cyrus, you're a genius, and I know you're going to sample that and use it all the time.
I already got that one.
I know you do. You've got that. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Lino in, where is it? Yerington, Nevada. Welcome, Lino.
Yes, it's Yerington, Nevada, Patrick. I wanted to tell you, and this is something you cannot be expected to know. My wife is Shoshone on her mother's side and Paiute on her father's side, and they were once involved in the sweat. And during that the time in which they were involved in it, her father and her mother made the claim that they were continually obsessed by demons that really darn near destroyed their lives. And when they made the claim that they accepted Jesus Christ, that all disappeared. And they basically, for the rest of their lives, they, in the Protestant sense, went to a Bible church. And they said that after that, they weren't bothered by it. But
when you say the sweat, do you mean like the sweat lodge ceremony? Is that what you're referring
to? Yes, I mean exactly that.
Okay, so this probably is in the context of a call that I got a few days ago where somebody asked about that. Okay.
Exactly. That's exactly
right. So for those
right.
who
it's
didn't
a very
hear
dangerous
it,
fra-
yeah, you're right. I gave my thoughts, and I'm not knowledgeable about what goes on in the sweat lodge ceremonies. So as I recall, I told the lady that if it was anything involving like religious rituals, involving sacrifice or invoking spirits or worshiping anything, stay far away from it. It's incompatible with your Catholic faith. But I think I said if it's something about, hey, let's purify our bodies and meditate and think nice thoughts, if it's something benign like that, I didn't see a problem with it. But it sounds like you have information about something more and negative involved than what I thought. Is that right?
Yes, that's exactly correct. And so I would not recommend anybody getting anywhere near it at this point.
And can you give me any specifics? Have you gone through it yourself, or is this coming from your wife's knowledge from her background?
I've been around it up in Fallon. I've been around it up in Idaho and so on. And it didn't affect me personally, but it affected her parents terribly. And they made that claim. I mean, her father made the claim that he almost was killed by these demons and so on. So I had to put my two cents in on this particular subject.
That's helpful. Yeah. And you said Shoshone. Yeah. What was the other tribe?
Her father was Paiute.
Paiute. Okay. Interesting. I have a good friend. He happens to be the Bishop of Gallup, New Mexico, Bishop James Wall, who is closely, you know, he lives closely among the native peoples who live in that area. I don't know if the Paiute is in that area or not, but I'm going to have to ask him what his thoughts are on this, because I should think he would have some insight as well. But I'm glad you called it and raised this red flag.
You're welcome. God bless. Well,
thank you, Lino. Thank you. To Greg now in the Quad Cities of Illinois. Hello, Greg.
Good morning, Patrick. Thank you for taking my call. A little nervous,
Certainly.
So long-time listener.
That's okay.
Question for you is, At Mass on Sunday, we had a visiting priest come in and give the homily. And then our priest said he was, you know, after the visiting priest left, our pastor came up and said, I didn't want to bring this up, but we've had issues where hosts, consecrated hosts, have been left in the pews. Sometimes it's been broken up in pieces. And he said this has been going on for the last couple of weeks. And he was very emotional about it and talked about, you know, some mortal sin going to hell, etc. My question is, what do they do with those hosts when they find them on the floor in the pew after Mass? I looked at my wife and we looked at each other. We didn't know what would happen. So that's kind of my question for you, Patrick.
Sure. And it's a horrifying thought to imagine people just leaving a consecrated host behind. You know, what a terrible blasphemy that is. So the Catholic Church foresees situations like this, and one of them would be, the one that would be the most common would either be to consume the host then and there, or to put the host in what's called a sacrarium. And it's a basin of water that would be filled, say, with holy water, for example. And the consecrated host would be placed in this basin and allowed to dissolve. Now, the reason that is a good way to go about this is that the real presence of Christ remains in the bread, or what appears now to be bread, and remains in the precious blood for as long as those elements have the properties of what they once were. So as long as it still has the properties of bread, then the real presence of Christ remains, the Church teaches. But when, let's say when you receive our Lord in Holy Communion, so in your mouth, and then it you either with your teeth or with your mouth, you sort of chew the host, or, you know, it becomes fragmented, and then you swallow it, and then the emulsification process takes place from your mouth down, and little by little it's being broken down. Well, it doesn't take very long before it's no longer bread. It's now something different because it has digestive juices and other things that are taking place. So that means that the real presence, at whatever point along the way that happens, the real presence is no longer there. So for this reason, by placing the host in the sacrarium, it is a way to respectfully make sure that the real presence of Christ is no longer there, so that when a day has gone by, or however much time, then if that goes down the drain, it's no longer a consecrated host. Now it's just the remnants of what once was bread. So that's how it would be handled typically if it's not consumed then and there. Does that help?
Patrick, thank you. Gives me a little bit of ease, because, again, that was, you know, there are evil people in the world. My wife had thought maybe it was a child, and I said, I hope it's a child that didn't really know. But, yeah, again, I appreciate you giving me that answer, Patrick.
Happy
thank
to.
You very much.
You're most welcome. Thank you. And, hey, everybody, I know that from time to time you may have a question about the sacraments, and you're wondering, well, what does the Church teach about this? What is the theology here, or what is the Church's law that applies in a given case? A book that I've used for many years, I profited greatly from it. It is called The Sacraments and Their Celebration by the late Father Nicholas Halligan. He was a Dominican friar and not only an expert on the sacraments, but also on canon law that governs the sacraments. And so if you're ever interested in a one-volume book that will take you through all seven sacraments and explain to you what is the form, what is the matter, what is the what must be present for validity, what are some ways in which it could be doubtful if this is a valid sacrament, and so on. It's just a very informative book, easy to read, too, and it's still available. I think it's Wipfenstock that publishes it now, but it's called The Sacraments and Their Celebration, and that is by Father Nicholas Halligan. May he rest in peace. I want to share with you something that I ran across I think is fascinating. This is an article by Susanna Spencer, How to Stop Being an Internet Glutton. Now, gluttony can take various forms. We're all familiar with binge-watching shows, and that I'm not saying that that's sinful, but I suppose if it's overly excessive, it can maybe border on sin if you're neglecting your duties, perhaps. That could be true of gaming or binging on Amazon Prime or food or drink, what have you. There are different ways in which we can be gluttons. And let's face it, you know, your human body is filled with appetites, and some of these irascible appetites are very difficult to command and subdue. So how do you do that when it comes to the internet? How do you avoid being an internet glutton and maybe being excessive in your use of the internet? And I got to tell you, I think I'm right there with everyone else. They make these phones so interesting, and the apps so bright and beautiful and interesting, and the things you can do with it and the power that you have at your fingertips with your phones is truly amazing. I mean, I've told my grandchildren before that there's far more computing power in the basic iPhone than all of NASA and Mission Control when we were sending men to the moon. And all the computers and everything that went into that was infinitesimally smaller when it came to computing power than the phone that you have on the desk in front of you or in your hand or in your pocket. It's just astonishing. So the reason is, I think that we can be so easily gluttonous when it comes to our consumption of the internet is because it's so interesting. And it kind of feeds into our natural human desire for bright colors and information and speed and all those things that people like. And I like them too. So here's what she says. This is the article by Susanna Spencer. We'll have a link to it for you on the show Twitter feed. She says, during one of my few undistracted times of reading, I came across a striking passage in St. John Cassian's Conferences. I was intrigued by the first-person account of a particular monk. So St. John Cassian is, he's a doctor of the church, I should say, and a very powerful and penetrating writer. So he says, I was never able to altogether get rid of the incentives to gluttony. For though I reduce the quantity of food which I take to the smallest possible amount, yet I cannot avoid the force of its daily solicitations. That's a very artful way of saying hunger. You know, maybe you don't eat very much food, but the food or the hunger in your body keeps reminding you of how much you want to eat it. But he says, yet I cannot avoid the force of its daily solicitations, but must be perpetually dunned by it, dunned as in constantly reminded of it, and be making, as it were, interminable payments by continually satisfying it and pay never-ending toll at its demand. So the author of the article says, the more I have tried to limit my use of the internet, the more I realize that this tool is a necessary part of life that I live. It is central to much of my work, managing my children's homeschool, cooking meals, keeping up on basics like the weather and the news, staying in touch with out-of-town relatives and friends, and my prayer life. She says, yet I can never seem to come to terms with it, especially since I got my first smartphone. St. John Cassian's teaching on how to overcome gluttony has some really great advice, which can be applied to all areas of intemperance. We must bear in mind that he wrote these things for monks, not lay people, so we should apply them to ourselves according to our own state in life. His words ring true when he says, quote, it is easier to find men who altogether abstain from the more fattening kinds of foods than men who make moderate use of what is allowed to our necessities. I'll reread that. It is easier to find men who altogether abstain from the more fattening kinds of foods than men who make a moderate use of what is allowed to our necessities. And I interpret that statement from St. John Cassian to mean, it's more likely that you're going to find people who go cold turkey and they just eliminate it entirely from their diet because at least that's manageable. It's an all or nothing kind of thing. But it takes an even greater level of self-control to make moderate use of those foods that are more fattening and still have them, but not overdo it. So like, give them an inch and you'll take a mile kind of thing. And so I can speak from experience. When it comes to certain foods, it's like the old potato chip commercial. Bet you can't eat just one. I think that was Lay's potato chips, I think.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah. I'm a pop culture guy. Bet you can't eat just one. And there's so much truth in that. You eat one of those potato chips and you hit your bliss point with the salt and the sweet and whatever else is going on, the crunch. And you can't eat just one. You got to have another one and another one and another one. So she says, it seems it would be easier to just give up the internet entirely, living off of social media, but it is more of a challenge to accept the internet as part of modern life and use it with temperance. The problem is how to form the habit of temperance. John Cassian recommends fasting, vigils, spiritual reading, building up in oneself a horror of sin and a desire for holiness. For a monk who wants to overcome gluttony. The goal is to get to the point where the need to eat is simply that, a necessity that one does not dwell on longer than he needs to. He makes a special note that fasting should be based on age, health, and condition in life. The problem with needing to eat is that it is a necessary part of our life, one that we cannot avoid, and we will always be plagued with temptations to gluttony. So, when a person wants to overcome intemperate internet use, St. John Cassian might recommend fasting from it on a certain day or at certain times, or having vigils of internet-free evenings, spiritual reading and prayer in place of social media use, trying to have a distaste for the distractions online, but most of all, building up a desire to grow in temperance and holiness. What one does should be based on age, condition, and life and health. Temperance towards something we use every day requires constant vigilance. So here are some tips from St. John Cassian on struggling with gluttony, whether it's gluttony of the internet or gluttony of something else. He says he will not in any case allow himself to be overcome by any delicacies or take anything to eat or drink before the fast is over and the proper hour for refreshment has come outside meal times, in other words, no snacking. Nor, when the meal is over, will he allow himself to take a morsel, however small. So when the meal is over and you push back from the table and you get up, you don't have any more. Easier said than done, may I say to you, at least in my life. Is that easier said than done for you too, Cyrus? Am I alone in this?
I am a all or nothing. So when I go on a diet, it means I can't have any anything of it. Yep, it's... I have to be very strict because if I allow myself just a little bit, it's over.
I know the feeling. There are times like when if I've given up, let's say, alcohol for Lent, wine especially, which I love, and maybe we're 3-4 weeks into it and we're out somewhere and Nancy will say, well, just have a little bit. You know, it's just not a big thing, just a little bit. And I say, honey, I can't because it'd be like a dam bursting. You know, if I have a little sip of it, then I'm going to want a glass of it. And that would throw me off my game. So I'm the same way, Cyrus, all or nothing. Do you ever find that your will is stronger than your won't?
Yeah, I have.
Or your won't is stronger than your will, as the case may be.
Nighttime,
I won't do it.
Nighttime Cyrus has some great ideas, and morning Cyrus wants nothing to do with nighttime Cyrus.
Hey, did you see that picture I posted of you on Twitter of you at the gym?
I gave you a response.
Oh, I didn't see that.
Yeah, I mean,
I was busy doing a radio show.
It's not really fair of you to be taking pictures of me while I'm working out.
But that's classic you at the gym.
It is.
Yeah,
that's me.
So one or two more tidbits here. Practically, the article says it might help to think of using the internet in the same way that you think of meals. A temperate person does not grab a piece of candy here and there between meals all day. Nor does the temperate person pick up the phone and check email, Instagram, Facebook, text messages, etc. every time there's a lull in the day. It's almost like she's looking over my shoulder.
I thought she was talking about me.
Yeah, I think most people hearing this are saying, how does she know that I do that all the time? I think most of us do. Cassian, St. John Cassian, talks about how gluttony or immoderate use of food leads to a dullness of one's senses and mind. She says, I have found for myself that even short but frequent taps into social media dull my mind for living in the present. I used to slip out of home life and avoid my reading and writing. Then the dullness of my mind creeps into my prayer life. I stop listening to the readings at Mass. I don't pray as attentively. And that is when I know it has become a problem yet again. So she talks about setting up a plan, making a set of resolutions, asking God for help, resolving that when you do go on the internet, you'll go there for specific reasons, have a specific purpose, etc., etc. And there's a few other little tidbits in here that I thought were quite helpful, and that would be a good thing, I think, for everyone to read, because we all are surrounded by the internet constantly. 888-914-9149. We will take a break. We'll come back. When we come back, rather, I'm going to share with you some specifics about how those apps that we talked a little bit about in the last few days, how exactly do they gather data about you? I'm going to tell you exactly how they do that right after this. This hour is sponsored by Ave Maria Mutual Funds, where financial goals are aligned with pro-life values and fund decisions are based on investment fundamentals designed to preserve and grow wealth without violating moral beliefs. More information at AveMariaFunds.com.
at the intersection of faith and culture. The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
We're back. This is the Patrick Madrid Show. I like that, Cyrus. Good. Play that again, please. I must have a second helping of that.
You want me to play that whole thing
again? I do.
Again?
Play it again, Sam. Right. Play it again.
At the intersection of faith and culture, the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
You see what I like most about that is that it's intensely dissatisfying.
You love it.
There's just something about that. You don't get the payoff.
Nope. We're all waiting for it.
I know.
And it just stops.
Yeah. It's just.
It's the ultimate Rickroll.
You put the brakes on. Yeah. Well, thank you. That was good. Twice. Even better. So before we go to the phones, I want to share with you, as I promised I would, some specifics. This is from the New York Times on how do these apps, how do they gather data about you? How can it be de-anonymized? How can it be used to triangulate on your activities in which third parties, whoever, can figure out where you go and what you do? And how could that be used against you? We saw the story in the news. We don't have to go back through all of that, but we saw the story in the news about the priest who had to resign from his high position at the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops because he had some bad apps on his phone. He had some immoral apps on his phone. At least that's the allegation. And these apps provided data that was used to triangulate with cell phone data that eventually led to a really clear-cut case about what, at least is alleged, about a long-standing habit of doing immoral things by using these apps. Okay. So the New York Times has an article about this. Popular dating services, and I'm not going to name them. They're named throughout this article. I don't want to draw attention to them. I don't want to give them free publicity. And I also don't want people to go looking for them. So those are my reasons. These popular dating services, and maybe we can put the word dating in quotation marks, because generally speaking, going to meet somebody for 20 minutes or half an hour and then never seeing that person again, I don't think that qualifies as dating. So hookup is a more common term to choose. So let's think of it that way. These services are spreading user information like dating choices and precise location to advertising and marketing companies in ways that may violate privacy laws, according to a new report that examines some of the world's most downloaded phone apps. One of them, which is the world's most popular gay dating app, transmitted user tracking codes and the app's name to more than a dozen companies, essentially tagging individuals with their sexual orientation, according to the report, which was released Tuesday by the Norwegian Consumer Council, a government-funded nonprofit organization in Oslo. That popular gay dating app also sent a user's location to multiple companies, which may then share the data with many other businesses, according to the report. When the New York Times tested that gay dating app, it shared precise latitude and longitude information with five companies. The researchers also reported that another hookup app sent a user's ethnicity and answers to profile questions like, have you used psychedelic drugs, to a third-party firm that helps companies tailor marketing messages to users. The New York Times found that that particular hookup app had recently posted a list of more than 300 advertising and analytics partners with which it may share users' information. Any consumer, now this is a quote from Finn Meierstad from the Norwegian Consumer Council that did the study. Any consumer with an average number of apps on their phone, anywhere between 40 and 80 apps, will have their data shared with hundreds or perhaps thousands of actors online. When I first read that line in this New York Times article, I opened my phone. I said, let's see, how many apps do I have? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 up, 1, 2, 3, 4 across. So 24, 48. Yeah. So I've got probably about 80 apps on my phone, which may be probably pretty common. So I'll just read that again. If you have an average number of apps on your phone, anywhere from 40 to 80, you'll have your data shared with hundreds or thousands of actors online, according to this Norwegian study. The report is called Out of Control, How Consumers Are Exploited by the Online Advertising Industry. And it adds to a body of growing research exposing a vast ecosystem of companies that freely track hundreds of millions of people and then peddle their personal information. This surveillance system enables scores of businesses whose names are unknown to you to quietly profile you and target you with ads and try to sway your behavior. The report appears just 2 weeks after California put into effect a broad new consumer privacy law. Among other things, the law requires many companies that trade consumers' personal details for money or other compensation to allow people to easily stop the spread of their information. In addition, regulators in the European Union are stepping up enforcement of their own data protection laws, which prohibit companies from collecting personal information on religion, ethnicity, sexual orientation, sexual activity, and other sensitive subjects without your explicit consent. The Norwegian group said it filed complaints on Tuesday asking regulators in Oslo to investigate that gay dating app, or the gay hookup app, and five tech ad companies that are responsible for violations of the European law. A coalition of consumer groups in the United States said it sent letters to American regulators, including the Attorney General of California, urging them to investigate whether these companies violate federal and state laws. In a statement, the Match Group, which owns two of these really big, very popular hookup apps, said that it worked with outside companies to assist with providing services and shared only specific user data that was deemed necessary for those services. They added that they complied with privacy laws and had strict contracts with vendors to ensure the security of users' personal data. Well, I'm going to pause there. Okay, but that priest who stepped down from the USCCB, it was easy, according to the reporting that I read, it was easy for the people who brought this information forth to not only get the data, but to de-anonymize it and to build their case that he was out doing some things that he should not have been doing. So when vendors and app companies say, oh, well, we have strict privacy laws and we have strict contracts with vendors, okay, but sure doesn't seem to work out that way in real life. In a statement, the gay dating app said that it had not received a copy of the report and could not comment. They added that they value users' privacy and they have put safeguards in place to protect their personal information and described its data practices and users' privacy options in its privacy policy. The report examines how developers embed software from ad technology companies into your apps to track you and your app use and your real-life locations. This is a common practice. So it really doesn't matter what apps you have on your phone. You have the Weather Channel on your phone? Let me see what I've got on my phone. Let's take a look here. So I've got a couple credit card apps so I can pay my credit card bills on my phone. I have a Relevant Radio app. I know that Relevant Radio isn't tracking you or me or anyone else. What else do I have? I have got a search engine. I've got an Amazon app. I've got a language app that helps me study languages all the time. I like that app a lot. Who knows what they're telling people about me? I have an Uber app. I have a Geico app. What else do I have? I have an Instacart app because from time to time we'll buy groceries with Instacart. I have, the rest of you, I have an American Airlines app because I fly in American Airlines a lot. I wonder what American Airlines is saying. Well, he flies here and he flies there. So, I mean, I think my data would be pretty boring, but I'm pretty confident that I've got any number of apps on my phone that I use all the time that are doing exactly what they're talking about. So you may say, okay, no big whoop, but it is a big whoop for the people who have, shall we say, compromising apps on their phone. You know, maybe the app that you put in a folder with a whole bunch of other apps so that if somebody glances at your phone, they won't see it, but it's in there. These things are broadcasting tons of information about you and your activities. Just be aware of that. Let's see. The report also examines how the developers using this ad technology, how they can find your real life location. It also helps them place ads in the apps that are designed to personalize their marketing services to you. The personal data that ad software extracts from apps is typically tied to a user tracking code, that is unique for your phone. So your mobile phone, doesn't matter what kind it is, it has a unique tracking code. In fact, it's probably visible if you go to the About section in the, you know, when you click on, so on the iPhone, you click on the gears, and the gears are the settings. So if you go to About, it's probably under General, go to About. Yeah, there it is. You can see the tracking number for your phone. It's right there. And so the people who are buying and selling your information, they have that. So the point about this is that even though your personal data is anonymized, the tracking code is there. So companies use the tracking code that's unique to your particular phone to build a rich profile about you over time across multiple apps and sites, but without your real names or your real name. Individuals in such data sets may be identified and located in real life if you simply match that unique identifying code that your phone has to you. In other words, who owns this phone? Who is the phone number registered to? That's easy to find out. For the report, the Norwegian Consumer Council hired Mnemonic, a cybersecurity firm in Oslo, to examine how ad tech software extracts user data from 10 popular Android apps. The findings suggest that some companies treat intimate information like gender preference or drug habits no differently than they do information like what's your favorite food. Among other things, the researchers found that the gay dating app sent a user's gender and the gender of the user and the gender that the user is looking to meet to two different marketing firms. The researchers did not test iPhone apps. Settings on both Android phones and iPhones enable users to limit ad tracking. The group's findings illustrate how challenging it would be for even the most intrepid consumers to track and hinder the spread of their own personal information, because it's already out there. The gay dating app, for instance, includes software from MoPub, Twitter's ad service, which can collect the app's name and a user's precise device location. MoPub, in turn, says that it may share user data with more than 180 partner companies. One of those partners is an ad tech company owned by AT&T, which may share data with more than 1,000 third-party providers. You getting the picture here? In a statement, Twitter said, "We are currently..." Oh, by the way, I have the Twitter app on my phone. So most of the time when I'm posting on Twitter, I'm posting from my phone. And Twitter, I mean, it is mind-boggling to imagine what you do on your phone and how many people know about it and track it and store it and then correlate it. It's mind-boggling. Twitter said in a statement, "We are currently investigating this issue to understand the sufficiency of that gay dating app consent mechanism. In the meantime, we have disabled their MoPub account." AT&T declined to comment. The spread of users' location and other sensitive information could present particular risks to people who use those kinds of apps in countries like Qatar and Pakistan, where those activities are illegal. So here's the thing. I mean, this is not coming. This is here. This is not down the road. It's here now. It's been here for a while. And I can't help but think about all the people who may be very, very nervous right now, because as this is coming to light and people are becoming maybe more painfully aware of how online habits and the things you do with your phone, it's all an open book. And whatever privacy you once thought you had using apps and things like that, you don't have it. You don't have that privacy. And you haven't had it for a while. So I come back to the God door, which is always the best place to finish things up here, and that is, let this be for all of us. Let this be for you a cautionary tale and an incentive to virtue. What do I mean by that? Well, what I mean basically is knowing now. I mean, let me put it this way. Have you ever seen, whether in pictures or maybe you've been to a city where they have these things, they have these public bathrooms, like on a busy street corner, that from the outside you look at it and it's all mirrors and you can't see in at all because it's all reflective and all you see is, you know, whatever's outside that public bathroom. Cyrus, have you seen one of these before? Maybe not in person, but have you seen pictures of these public bathrooms that are like that?
Yeah, very weird.
Very weird. Okay, and what's really weird about it is when you go inside, It's see-through. It's a see-through mirror. So on the inside, you can see out as if you were looking through perfectly clear windows. And the weirdness of it is, for the person inside this bathroom, you can see out, and you can see, it looks to you like everybody would be looking at you, but they can't see you because from the outside, it's reflective. Okay. This deal with the apps on your phone is basically the reverse of that, where you think nobody can see what you're doing. But in reality, all of these hundreds and thousands of people whose business it is to make money from you by storing this data about you, including the most sensitive of things, depending upon what kind of apps you're using, they can all see what you're doing.
Oh, that makes me so uneasy.
Mm-hmm. I would never use one of those bathrooms just because of the psychological. It just would be, no, I wouldn't do it. But it makes you think twice about what you put on your phone or what you do with your phone, or it should. So that's my God door right there. It's just, let this be an incentive to virtue. The more virtuous you are, the less of a problem this will be. And I guess maybe for some people, it may be too late now. Because if they had the information on that one particular person, and the accounts are saying there was some sort of list of multiple people, and who knows how many that is, I don't know, but I can only imagine that for people who maybe are getting a head start on this, you can say, I'm glad I know this now, and I'm not going to go down that road, and I'm not going to do the things, you know, that I think are secret and private that nobody knows about, that everybody actually can easily find out about. Ooh,
it's
talk
just
about
a matter of time before there's one morning we're going to wake up and everything we've ever done online is going to be accessible to everyone else.
Yay.
Yep.
As my grandmother used to say, oh joy.
Yeah, can't wait.
No. You know, but you know what? Let's go out on this note. Jesus said that whatever is done in the darkness will be brought out to the light. Whatever you do in secret will be shouted from the rooftops. And this is essentially a 21st century secular reminder of what Jesus said. So let's take Jesus seriously and live our lives accordingly. That's what I think. 888-914-9149. We'll come right back. I can see people frantically deleting apps on their phone all across the country after reading that New York Times article. I'll be right back. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on Coast to Coast on Relevant Radio.
We're going to go to the phones in a second. First, though, a shout out to Bill Moody, one of our Twitter friends who loves interacting with us. Thank you, Bill. He posted something. Cyrus, you should look at it. It's funny. It's the HAL 9000 red unblinking eye from 2001, A Space Odyssey. And his caption is, I'm sorry, Dave, but I can't stop tracking you.
Bill is really funny.
Yeah,
funny guy. I love it. Yeah, every day he posts something funny.
Well done, Bill.
Yeah, well done.
Yeah, thank you. Let's go to Tony in California. Hi, Tony. Hi, Tony.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, Patrick. How are you?
I'm well, thanks.
I'm sorry. I'm not supposed to say how are you. Thank you for all you do. And
you're welcome. Thanks.
Helping my wife and I grow in our faith. Anyways, trying to make it quick and short. Okay. The past 3 or 4 years, the company I work for has changed its culture. They're more to inclusion than focusing on the work that we do.
Okay.
And it's kind of really bothering me at work, and I don't know how to push back. They've implemented inclusion.
Are you being asked to do something that would compromise your beliefs?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay. Can you give me an example?
A couple of things. One, I'm a Filipino-American, and they implemented an Asian professional construction. They like to invite you, but don't really force you. Okay. You know, you get a lot of emails. And Asian geographic continent, you know, they also included the Polynesian Islands. What do the Polynesian Islands have anything to do with, you know, folks Asia. From Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Asia? It's huge. You know, they don't have anything in common. They just want to have inclusion for the sake of inclusion. Hey, look at our company. You're very inclusive, but it's really forcing folks apart.
Okay.
I'm Filipino-American, and, you know, there's history in World War II between the Filipinos and the Japanese.
Right.
My mom, you know, doesn't like the Japanese because my grandfather was brutally beat up during World War II. They would have shot him. She spoke Japanese and pleaded for her life in Japanese.
Okay.
Because my grandfather didn't want to tell the Japanese that where the Americans and Filipinos are. And
right.
Second, June was Pride Month, and my values are traditional male and female families.
Mm-hmm.
I was sent decorations to decorate my cubicle with rainbow flags, and, you know, I didn't put it up. My brother's gay. I've got gay and lesbian nieces and nephews and cousins. I love them with all my heart, but, you know.
So what is it that they're asking you to do? Do they want you to put up decorations? And if they say that, can you just say, no, thanks, I'm not going to put them up? Could you do that?
Yeah, I could. I could, but every year that's going to happen, you know. In June, the month of June, every year from this point forward is, you know, Pride Month.
That's true. And I think we're stuck with that. So my question then would be, how much do you like your job? If you love your job and the pay is good and there are lots of reasons to want to stay there, then I would say I would just deal with it and put up with it and, you know, grin and bear it once a year. If you can get by doing that and you love the job enough, then that's what I would do. But if you don't love the job that much, if you could get a better job maybe or a different job that would pay as well as you're getting there and you could make a jump and not have to deal with this stuff, then that's what I would do. You know, you do a cost-benefit analysis and how much pain is involved here and how much upside is there. And if the upside outweighs the pain and you can see your way clear to just toughing it out, tough it out. But if there's more pain than gain, then I would jump ship and go somewhere else.
Okay. My point is, if I do stay, you know, and fight it with HR or fight for my rights, you know, there's a lot of folks that are in my vote but are afraid to speak because they may be fired.
Right.
So.
And they may crush you.
You know.
And do you want to have on your job record that you were fired from a job, even if what you were fired for was ridiculous? That then would be on your employment record. So when you go to the next place, they're going to say, well, you were fired from the last job. What happened there? And then if you say, well, I was standing up against all this nonsense, they may say, maybe we don't want this guy because maybe he's a troublemaker.
Okay.
Not that you are, but
I've been in the company for 25 years.
I can imagine.
I've been with the company for 20 years. Yeah.
Yeah. So wouldn't that offer you some protection?
Great.
Your seniority?
Yeah. That's why I'm willing to fight HR or even hire a lawyer to see what my rights are. And if they fire me, I'm almost retiring. So, you know.
Okay. Yeah. Fair enough. And you know the lay of the land. I don't. So obviously trust your instincts. But what I'm saying is if it's not necessary that you push it, then why push it? If it's just a matter of they say, hey, here's a rainbow pride flag. Can you put that up in your cubicle? And you don't, and they don't say anything about it, and they don't bother you about it beyond that, then why not just let it ride? Why provoke something?
I guess it's, you know, like you said, you know, if you don't say anything, then you're accepting. So,
take a cue, Tony. Here's an interesting historical thing to consider. Take a cue from St. Thomas More, who was, I'm sure you know the story, he was the Lord Chancellor of England when Henry VIII broke with the Catholic Church. And Henry VIII, he demanded that all of his subjects take the oath of supremacy, acknowledging him as the head of the Church of England and acknowledging their allegiance to the Church of England, not to the Pope of Rome, etc., etc. And he demanded this of all of his subjects, including St. Thomas More. And St. Thomas More, basically, he didn't do it, didn't say anything. He was silent on that. He says, I pray for you, my Lord the King, I pray for you. But he just stood his ground and didn't do it. And he didn't say anything. Now, in his case, eventually, Henry VIII imploded and he demanded it. And then when it became clear that he was going to kill him, then he finally spoke up and denounced what he was doing. But he was not wrong in saying and doing nothing and just waiting for the hammer to fall. He wasn't doing anything wrong. And he certainly wasn't accepting the evil that Henry VIII was trying to perpetrate by being silent. So I would offer you that something to consider, that I don't think it is necessarily the case that if you don't say anything that you're somehow consenting to it. I don't buy that perspective.
Okay.
You know?
Okay. Okay, I'll ponder on it.
Ponder on it. Just give it some thought.
I'm just going to input.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm talking to HR right now, and they're just letting me know, you know, be quiet, you know, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I've, this is my fourth time talking to HR. I didn't want to file anything because it sucks up a lot of time to do an investigation, but it's been happening for quite a while, and I think
if you continue with that, I wouldn't be surprised if they say, you know, this guy's a headache. Let's find some way that we can document and get legally in the clear to cut this guy loose because he's a headache. And I would hate to see that happen to you.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I appreciate it, Patrick. Thank you for all you do.
Thank you. Hang in there. And I hope that there's a happy resolution for you. 888-914-9149. Let's go now to Lucy in Los Angeles. Hi, Lucy.
Hi, good morning. I have a question on one of the Ten Commandments.
Okay.
The one about keeping holy the Lord's Day or the Sabbath day.
Right.
Is going to a restaurant where someone else is working to serve the food or cook the food, or going to a professional sports event in any way violating the Third Commandment?
Well, I don't think it is. Pope John Paul II, in his, an encyclical, I think it was, Dies Domini, which is the day of the Lord, he touches upon that issue. And as I recall, I think he says basically, if it's something that contributes to or perfects your observance of the Sabbath, having a meal with your family, and you can do that at a restaurant, that's fine. There's nothing sinful there. And nor are you causing the person who's working at the restaurant to sin if his shift is on a Sunday. I've always told my children as they were growing up, ask your employer, if at all possible, please don't let me work on Sunday, because I want to keep that day separate and for God. And more often than not, the employer will understand it. But sometimes if the employer says, no, we need you on Sunday, you have to work on Sunday, the employee is not doing anything sinful, because that it's a necessity. And the spirit of the commandment is to not do anything that's unnecessary by way of work or that kind of thing. So if you could go shopping any day of the week and you don't need to go to the grocery store to buy stuff for Sunday dinner, then don't go. But if you have Sunday dinner planned and, oh, we didn't get this or that or the other and we need to pick that up because we have family coming over, and you zip over to the store to buy what you need, that would not be a sin because it's something necessary.
Good. That's good to hear. I kind of felt that way, but I just wasn't sure, and I wanted to ask you. Could I ask you a second question?
Sure, sure.
Someone was asking me, a young girl was asking me, if you think Jesus had a guardian angel.
I believe Jesus had countless guardian angels. We know this, for example, when he was tempted in the desert. We're told that at the end of his confrontation with the devil that, you know, angels came and ministered to him. It doesn't tell us how many, but I'm sure there were many. So,
okay.
Yes, I would say this is sort of an a fortiori argument, that if you and I have at least one guardian angel, how much more so would the Son of God himself have angels attending to him during his earthly life?
Okay, I'll let her know.
Yeah. Great book on that, is Angels and Devils by Joan Carol Cruz. It's a very helpful book that gets into a lot of those details.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you. I know, because I know that Cyrus has his finger on the man's got to know his limitations. I knew it that you had your finger on that button.
You're a legend in your own mind.
Me or you? Cyrus has a new soundboard. So that's my way of finding out that we don't have enough time to take another call.
Yes, that's true.
You're frantically scrambling to find another sound.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah, that's true. You're right. Okay, well, let's rev the engines and come back for hour three. This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app. We have plenty ahead, so don't tune away. In fact, give me a call. We'll talk. 888-914-9149. I'll be right back.
Get that in your spirit.